This is our year-end show, and my name is Allison Kulo. I'm one of the co-hosts of Mountain Money, along with Doug Wells and Roger Goldman. No matter which way you look at it, there is a lot we can look back on this year. For this episode, I went back and looked for interesting stories that we covered. There are four that I'm going to highlight today. The first is with Professor Derek Hamilton from Ohio State. Hamilton is the executive director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Our second look back is with Trevor Milton with Nikola Motor Company, which we covered both before and after their downfall. Nancy Vollmer with the Salt Lake City International Airport joined Mountain Money in September to talk about the new SLC. I thought it would be fun to listen again to the improvements at the Salt Lake City Airport, especially for those who have not been able to travel this year. Our final interview we've highlighted is with David Damshin, the Utah State Treasurer. This is a good one, trust me. The first interview is one Roger Goldman and I conducted on Martin Luther King Day this year. That day, we visited with Professor Derek Hamilton from Ohio State. Hamilton is the executive director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Hamilton provides perspective on race inequalities and talks about the next iteration for us to have a better democracy, the fulfillment of an economic bill of rights. This interview was conducted on January 20th, 2020.
Today, as we celebrate the legacy of Dr. King, it is useful to reflect both on how far we as a nation have come with respect to racial inequality and how far we have to go. In terms of how far we have come, I grew up in Hampton, Virginia in the 1950s and am thus old enough to remember segregated movie theaters where, quote, the colored people, end quote, would have to sit in the balcony, as well as the separate water fountains in the bathroom so well depicted in the film Hidden Figures, which happened to be set in Hampton. Those striking and explicit elements of segregation are, of course, long gone. But the realities of the economic racial divide remain stark.
School children today are often exposed to Dr. King's famous August 1963 speech, I Have a Dream, and the events of that day are credited for having a direct effect on the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1963 and the Voting Rights Act of 1964. But that speech was given as part of something labeled the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. When organizer A. Philip Randolph initially wrote to Dr. King about the march, he described it as a march for Negro job rights. In addition to civil rights and voting rights, the goals that day included a massive federal works program to train and place unemployed workers. So it has been some 55 years since the passage of the landmark civil rights legislation of the Johnson administration. Today, we would like to spend a little time examining the persistent racial wealth and income gaps that exist in spite of these and other laws and regulations aimed at ending discrimination. What are the dimensions of the wealth and income gaps? What are their causes? And what, if anything, can be done to try and address them?
We are so fortunate to have with us this morning Professor Derek Hamilton, the executive director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, and a professor at the John Glenn College of Public Affairs at Ohio State University. Thank you for joining us on a day when I know there are no classes being held in Columbus. Good morning.
Thank goodness there are no classes being held. Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
Dr. Hamilton, let's start by sort of giving an overview. What's the best way to understand the nature and extent of the wealth gap in this country?
It's dramatic and persistent. I mean, to put it in perspective, the typical black household has about 10 cents on the dollar as a typical white household. And also, to give some more perspective, we often think about wealth as an outcome, but the real value of wealth is what it can do for you, the agency it provides to make decisions in your life. So if we think of wealth as an input in a host of a variety of other outcomes associated with one's well-being, we can see how dramatic the racial wealth divide still is.
And is there a similar income gap? I mean, let's talk about the differences between wealth and income for just a minute.
Sure. I mean, conceptually, income is a flow good. It is typically a reward that occurs over some period, and often it is in exchange for labor, but it can also be a reward for assets you have, or compensation, or some sort of return for one's labor. So it's a flow good. It happens periodically, and people often use their income to manage their day-to-day lives. But wealth, on the other hand, is a stock. Wealth is an accumulation of everything that you own versus everything that you own, all your assets versus everything that you owe. And when you think about the two concepts, wealth can be more transformative. So if you have a big ticket item, you will often finance it with wealth as opposed to income, like an expensive college education. Or if you're confronted with an expensive legal system, wealth becomes a stronger indicator of one's well-being than income when we think about big ticket items. And then the last point is that wealth is something that can go on in perpetuity. You know, income, like I said, is a periodic flow good that typically once you use it, it's exhausted. Of course, you can save some of your income. But wealth, on the other hand, not only can you use it, but it also has a rate of return associated with it. So it has almost a perpetuity frame that it's not exhausted, but rather continues.
And that perpetuity frame obviously extends to intergenerational passage of wealth, I take it.
You are spot on. In fact, you raised the question about some of the causes of wealth inequality versus income inequality. The point that you just made, that it has an intergenerational aspect, points to a history of degradation and lack of access to Black Americans that's strongly contributing to the racial wealth gap that we see today.
I think with regards to the racial wealth gap, it's not that, well, I think one, there's a mindset that social mobility is in the hands of individuals, but as well, there's also additional factors that have been impacting that. So could you describe what legal and regulatory factors that have contributed to the persistent financial gap?
To the financial gap? Mm-hmm. Sure. So, you know, we can think about access to credit and, you know, what is it? How do most Americans generate wealth? Most Americans generate their wealth in a passive way. They have access to a vehicle of savings, like a retirement account or having a home, where rather than paying consumption in terms of rent, you're paying towards debt reduction in the form of a mortgage, and that house will appreciate over time. So how do you get into something like home ownership? Well, you get a down payment, perhaps from some government program or from a relative, a family member, a parent, or some inheritance that allows you to overcome the barrier of being able to place a down payment with 20% down. And then the second component is the terms by which you have to pay back that mortgage. So you can imagine two households that face very different terms of paying back a mortgage terms, and one will be dramatically disadvantaged compared to the other. So, you know, again, just to reiterate, there are two factors. One is that initial down payment and then the terms of the credit to begin with. And we have a long history and current history of predation towards Black Americans.
You know, one of the pieces that I got to read of yours over the weekend dealt directly with housing, and in particular, sort of the racially disparate impact of the post-World War II housing programs, followed by, other predatory mortgage kinds of practices. Let's talk. Can you sort of help the audience understand a little bit about how that history gets us to where we are?
A great question. And let me also point out the fact that regardless of race, millennials are particularly not doing well compared to previous generations at a similar point in their life. So the paper you referenced points out, and this paper is done in conjunction with Chris Famagetti, one of my graduate students from when I was at the New School. The paper points out that similarly aged millennials, and compared to every other generation dating as far back as the greatest generation, who came into adulthood nearly 100 years ago, right after the Great Depression, the millennials today have lower home ownership rates than all those previous generations, except the greatest generation. So, you know, why is that relevant? If you purchase a home at a young age, given the structure in which home ownership is done in the United States, it's often a vehicle by which people are able to accumulate assets over time. So, regardless of race, millennials are not doing well compared to previous generations. Millennials coming out of the Great Recession, where liquidity has become more stringent in terms of ability to put a down payment on a home or get credit from a bank. Also, coming out of the Great Recession, where they have perhaps less resources compared to other generations. And then also coming out of the Great Recession, when now student debt is a critical issue. Millennials have record-breaking numbers of record-breaking levels of student debt, which puts them at a disadvantaged position compared to previous generations. But all that said, when we look at black-white inequality within generations, the racial wealth gap in home ownership for millennials is larger than any other generation also previously. So we have this double phenomenon for black families or black millennials, where not only is the rate low for millennials in general, the racial gap is even more pronounced than previous generations. So however bad millennials are doing in general, it is dramatically worse for black millennials.
So with regard to housing, you gave the example of where there's that inequality, but the wealth gap and income gap also create inequality and inability to access things such as political influence, education, and health care. How does that impact, and how does that kind of continue this pattern when there's less access to those types of influences?
Yeah, I mean, again, we think about income and wealth as an outcome in and of themselves, but what we really have to grasp is the economic power that's associated with those outcomes, especially wealth. The ability to make political donations or exert influence through a variety of ways, if you have wealth, to structure the game in your favor, not only can you use that wealth to personally enhance yourself, you can also structure society in a way that enhances you and your demographic also with wealth. So, you know, we need to think about the plutocratic nature of wealth as well. So if we look at American wealth inequality broadly, we have a scenario where we are as concentrated in the domain of wealth as we've ever been, dating all the way back to basically the Great Depression, when we were just coming out of the Gilded Age and we had that large wealth disparity. So what does that do? It's anti-democratic, because you have such high levels of concentration where one statistic shows that the top, not 1%, but 0.1%, those earning above $1.5 million a year, have more wealth than the entire bottom 90% of all Americans. Moreover, the bottom 50% of earners in America own about 1% of America's wealth. And, you know, I'm saying all of that, and we're here on Martin Luther King Celebration Day, that despite that massive concentration, race is still a bigger predictor of one's class status in the domain of wealth than class itself. So imagine how unequal we are, that scenario I just described for you. It's even worse when we think about race. And as you raised before, the point you raised, Allison, that this not only is about inequality in terms of wealth, it has reverberating effects throughout our economy and throughout many other outcomes when we think about the power that wealth affords us.
So this starts to perhaps go back to an economic bill of rights, setting out an equality of people within this nation, and then, as you're saying, kind of throughout their lifetime. With regards to this, if this were to be implemented, how many years or how many generations do you think it would take to be able to reduce that gap?
Yeah, so Naomi Zewedi, she did a projection of baby bonds and finds dramatic closure after, I believe it's even within one generation, not complete closure, but dramatic closure for those individuals that would be recipients of the account. So you can imagine that baby bonds is something that is a prospective approach that would, in perpetuity, trend us towards closing wealth inequality across class and race. But, you know, as you mentioned, Allison, there is no one silver bullet policy to think about in our framework. So baby bonds would address wealth, but an economic bill of rights would include dimensions of ensuring that every American has access to quality health insurance, for example. That might include, say, Medicare for All. It would include ensuring that every American has access to credit, short-term credit, an account, and that could include public banking to put a floor on the financial sector so that the most vulnerable in our society aren't susceptible to predation from a finance industry that has an exorbitant amount of power relative to a consumer who really has no assets at all and very little choice. It would include debt-free college education, because we can extend the promise of education to Americans well beyond high school at this 21st century point in our history. You know, I can keep going on with some other policies that it would also include, but let me also point out one: that we need to allow the free mobility in society without the threat of being sanctioned by the state because of one's race or ethnicity. So not only should we think about economic Bill of Rights, we should certainly think about one's personhood, being able to roam free without being threatened. Let me just say, last thing, I know I'm rambling on a little bit here, but we're talking about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. The next iteration for us to have a better democracy is the fulfillment of an economic Bill of Rights. And I would say people like Roosevelt, they started us on that trend when we established policies like Social Security, which literally ended poverty. Well, it didn't quite end it. Dramatically reduced poverty for our elderly population. If we imagine a society now where our next iteration is an economic Bill of Rights, beyond just thinking about civil rights, that will bring us to the more perfect democracy that we've been trying to trend towards. And also in our history, if we go back, we want to make sure that this current economic Bill of Rights is done in a way that is race and gender conscious, so as to not exclude people by both policy design and policy implementation. So when we originally initiated Social Security, we excluded domestic workers and we excluded agricultural workers. Well, by design and implementation being a Jim Crow South, and not just the South, but even other parts of the country, that was highly discriminatory. So this iteration of an economic Bill of Rights would ensure economic inclusion by both design and implementation so that we don't leave anybody behind.
I know you can't quite answer this, but I just wonder what could be accomplished if we could get there.
You know, I'll give you another tidbit, and that is, you know, I had a conversation with Senator Sanders about a federal job guarantee. And, you know, he very much liked the idea. And there are other senators as well that have been warming up to this idea of a federal job guarantee. But in presenting it to Senator Sanders, I tried to say, think about all the things that it's accomplished in the past. Think about all the big programs, all the highway construction, all the ways that it's impacted. If we think about individual narratives, people might be able to turn to a grandparent who might find that they might turn to their grandparent who was part of WPC or the CCC, WPA or the CCC, and talk about in a iterative way the narrative of how it affected their family. What Senator Sanders said to me was, you know, that's great and fine. So he didn't poo-poo any of that, but he said, think about the future. Think about how we could reimagine a society that we want and deserve. And I think that is another way in framing to think about an economic Bill of Rights. As we face our climate crises, you know, if Americans were prospective and imagined what could we achieve in the future, I think that's almost even a better way of framing than looking back to our past.
I think that is a pretty inspirational note for us to conclude on. Thank you so much for joining us on this special day. It's been inspirational to listen to some of these ideas. We appreciate you taking the time with us.
Again, that interview originally aired on January 20th, 2020. Our next look back is focused on Trevor Milton. 2020 was a big year for Trevor Milton and his company, Nikola Motor Company. Mountain Money had a chance to speak with Milton about his company in April. Doug Wells and Roger Goldman interviewed Milton on April 27th, 2020.
Our second guest is CEO of Nikola Motor Company, which is a hydrogen trucking transport company with some very unique aspects to their business. Nikola Motor is led by its founder and serial entrepreneur, our guest this morning, Trevor Milton, who has spent the last 7 years in Class 8 truck industry, focusing on recalibration of diesel engines and emissions. He then went on to looking at high-pressure natural gas and hydrogen storage. Nikola's business model results in zero emissions from production to consumption.
And indeed, last November, Nikola partnered with Anheuser-Busch and assisted with the first zero-emissions beer delivery in the brewer's hometown of St. Louis. The hydrogen electric truck picked up a load of beer and delivered it to an Anheuser-Busch local distributor, marking the first commercial delivery using a Nikola hydrogen electric vehicle. This was an important step toward Nikola's goal to produce 600 battery electric trucks in 2021 and 7,000 battery electric and 5,000 fuel cell electric trucks in 2024.
Right now, there's a lot of things on our guest's plate, such as negotiating his business through the COVID-19 crisis, a lawsuit they have with Tesla, and taking the company public. Trevor joins Mountain Money this morning to talk about a number of the tasks facing Nikola. Trevor, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money. So, Trevor, you were a guest on the show not quite 2 years ago. I think it was November 2017. A lot of where Nikola Motors is today was aspirational back then. Remind our listeners, where was Nikola Motors? What was your company like 2 years ago? And then share with us what Nikola is like today, where you guys are today.
Yeah, I mean, a few years ago, we actually were in Utah. We started our company in Utah, up in Salt Lake City. And our dream, I mean, this company started back, you know, 5-6 years ago. Our dream was really to build a zero-emission electric locomotive-style semi-truck. And, you know, the performances of electric motors are awesome, but there was a lot of problems back then with batteries and being very heavy and not economical. So we started kind of before it became a thing. When we first started, every other OEM, which is an equipment manufacturer like Volvo or Daimler or Peterbilt, they came out and they're like, this will never work. Nikola's total vaporware. And so that was kind of a fun little jab. When they said that, it just kind of incentivized all of us to even work harder. And we built this electric semi-truck company with the understanding that we would never succeed unless we were able to control the energy that went into the vehicle, because that's really where all the money is. And so just a quick example of that is when you buy a diesel truck, you spend $150,000 for the truck, but you spend $1 million on the fuel over the life. So we wanted to make sure we were the ones that actually controlled the $1 million like the oil companies, but in a clean zero emission method. And so that's where we were. And now we're down in Phoenix, Arizona at our headquarters where we're building a factory. And we're hiring hiring people as fast as we can, trying to navigate this coronavirus thing. We'll start full production next year. So pretty incredible to see where we came from to where we are now.
So you've gone beyond the prototype stage. If you're really looking at full production, what are you looking at in terms of production levels, and where are you in terms of orders?
Yeah, so, I mean, we stopped taking orders at a little over about, I think it was over $10 billion worth of reservation revenue. We stopped taking orders at that point. It just got to the point where people were 7 years out on order logs, and it just made everyone mad. So at that point, that's when we stopped taking orders. Where we are right now, our factory, we have two factories. We have one going up here in Phoenix, and we break ground on that one in the middle of this year. And that'll probably take about 2 to 3 years before it's actually up and running. So how do we build our trucks until then? We signed a very large joint venture with Iveco out of Europe. Iveco is one of the largest truck manufacturers in the world. They came to us, they saw our technology, and they said, hey, how do we partner with you guys? We know how to build trucks. We're really good at that. And you guys, Nikola, you guys know how to do a lot of technology that we're not good at. How do we come together? So we partnered with them, and we have a factory in Ulm, Germany, being finalized right now. So it'll be done in the next 6 months-ish with trucks coming off the line. So all of our trucks will be built in the Ulm, Germany for the first year or two. And then after that, our U.S. factory will come online and supply all the U.S. trucks from here as well.
Several stories about the company have been in the news lately. One of them deals with this lawsuit against Tesla. Can you explain to us what that lawsuit's about and where it stands?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask about that because, you know, we're actually big fans of Tesla. And so we get a lot of heat online and elsewhere. They're like, how can you sue Tesla? We can't believe you guys. And what it really came down to is we have some very specific intellectual property, and it's really important to our company and our success and also our investors. This intellectual property is how a truck is, different design aspects of the truck, not just a design patent, but these are actually utility patents too, which means they function as a utility. That is, for instance, like where a side door is located behind the driver. What a lot of people don't know is I'm a pilot as well. I love to fly. And I designed the truck to where you would enter the truck from behind the door, behind the seat, just like you would in an aircraft. By doing that, you can move the driver up to the front of the cab. And there's a whole bunch of other design and utility patents involved with this. And what that does is it helps you gain aerodynamic advantages that no one else in the world can ever gain. It turns it into a bullet train style or a very, very aerodynamic truck. And so when Tesla was about ready to launch their truck, we reached out to them. We told them, hey, guys, look, we know that you guys are launching a truck that we hear looks very similar. We need to talk to you guys. Please call us. You know, we don't want to go down this path of any type of enforcement. You know, please call us. We need to work through this. And their answer essentially is piss off. So that was a hard one for us because we really like Tesla. We wanted to work with them. We wanted to help them get design, you know, essentially, hey, look, just don't use our patents, but we want you to succeed. How can we work together so you can succeed? And they took a very, you know, they're the ones that really started it. That's what the public doesn't understand is we tried to work with them and they just refused to ever even engage in a conversation with us. And finally, we just, you know, we had to defend our investors and our people. And so we have a, you know, recently they tried to invalidate our patents with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. And we won that ruling. They came back and said, no, Nikola's patents are very strong, very secure. They were written well. They were done correctly. And we don't see a reason why we would ever invalidate or modify Nikola's patents.
A place that you've been in the news recently has been your philanthropic activities here in the local, in our listening area, and specifically the paying of some utility bills for some local past due residents. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and how you came to this program?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I love small towns. People, they'll get to know me. I'm a small town lover. On all levels. I think some of the best people on this planet come out of small towns. And I grew up in a town called Kanab for a little while, and it's in Utah. It's a very small, you know, very small town. And I saw the devastation that the impact has on any type of economic problem. It becomes like a major problem for the small towns. And so I've done pretty well. You know, I was able to save up some money in my life and, you know, a lot of people think, you know, there's a lot of articles out there about how, you know, that I'm a billionaire on paper. The problem is it's only on paper. It's not in cash. So this money doesn't just like flow from an unlimited well. It's a very limited amount. I took a pledge that I was going to give away about 50% of all my life, all my savings, all my personal savings that I pay taxes on. And that's about $650,000 that I decided I was going to give away to families that were in need. I took about half of what I had saved. And the rest of my wealth is on paper. So have I done very well on paper? Yes, I have. If the company does well, I'll have made more money than I'll probably ever be able to spend in my lifetime. But in cash, I took half of everything I had in cash, half of all my savings, and I made a pledge on my birthday that I was going to help people in my community that were hurt. So I have a ranch in up in Oakley, and I called the mayor of Oakley. I called the mayor of Camas, and I said, how much is outstanding? How many people are past due? How bad is this coronavirus hurt everybody? And their answer was, it's been catastrophic. And I said, okay, I want you to do me a favor. And it's not just a favor to me, but it's a favor to your community. If you're a great mayor, I think you'll do this. If you guys will discount all past due bills by 25%, I will come in personally and I will wipe off every single past due bill you have in your entire city. And these are for people. This is not for me. It's not for anything. This is for people. These are families that are hurting, that can't pay their electric bill, their water bill, their propane bill, things like that. Every county, every city has different utilities, you know, trash, water, everything else. So I came in and I wiped off the entire past due bills of both the city of Camas and Oakley. And then I went to Hone Propane and I did the same thing with Hone Propane. I said, look, I know you guys provide propane to most of the residents here for their heating bills. If you'll discount your the past due bills, I'll come in and I'll wipe these off. And some of these have been past due for 2, 3, 4 years. They're never going to get that money. And so it brought a lot of hope to these residents. I mean, I can't even tell you how many residents we've had just randomly show up or send us emails or letters, and like a loaf of bread that they baked, and just, you know, kind of in their letter, you could hear that they're just crying. Like, thank you so much for doing that for us. We had no hope. And you guys were, you know, it's so nice to see someone actually care about people.
Well, it's,
so that was what I did.
Yeah. It's a very generous thing that you did. It's a very hopeful thing. And hopefully it acts as a model for others. So it takes generosity from individual citizens. It unfortunately also takes a ton of stimulus from the federal government to get us through this. But we do want to thank you both for your generous offer to the cities of Camas and Oakley and for being a guest on Mound Money this morning. Thank you very much.
As the year progressed, more information came out regarding Nikola Motor Company. CNBC's market reporter Pippa Stevens joined Mountain Money in October to lay out the downfall. Roger Goldman and I spoke with Stevens on October 12, 2020.
Back on April 27th, we had Trevor Milton, then CEO of Nikola Motor Corporation, on Mountain Money to discuss the company and where it was going. At the time, it was a rather high-flying company, and the stock associated with the SPAC that had acquired Nikola was trading in the high 90s. But then things began to unravel.
When short-selling firm Hindenburg Research released a report accusing the company of making false statements about its technology, things began to unravel. Pippa Stevens, market reporter for CNBC, wrote an article in September that looked at Nikola's saga through the lens of three storylines recently captivating Wall Street. Pippa joins us today to walk us through the current route of Nikola's shares and shines a spotlight on the potential dangers of these three trends. Thanks for joining us, Pippa.
Good morning, and thanks so much for having me.
Let's break down these trends that you indicated in your reporting, and let's start with the special purpose acquisition companies. What are they, and what are their significance in the marketplace?
Yeah, so essentially, a special purpose acquisition company, which is also known as a SPAC, is an empty shell that raises money through a traditional IPO with the ultimate end goal of acquiring or merging with another company, and a company that's typically private. They generally have about 2 years to complete this deal. And so SPACs are also known as blank check companies, because when investors buy into their IPO, they have no idea what their money is ultimately going to be used for. They have no idea what that end target is going to be. So they're really trusting the management team of that SPAC sponsor.
So let's take that information that you just gave us and break it down with regards to Nikola. Where and how were SPACs involved with Nikola, and how perhaps was that a downfall or a negative for that company?
Yeah, so we've seen a huge amount of interest in electric vehicle companies merging with SPACs this year, and Nikola really kicked off that trend. They went public on June 4th through a reverse merger with Vecto IQ, which was a SPAC that was headed by a former GM executive. And so there was just incredible interest right off the bat. You know, on the first day of trading, the stock opened around $31, and then a few days later, it hit $94. So that was a bunch of investors, including retail investors, piling in.
We talked about its rise, which was rather meteoric. Talk to us about what happened and why it fell so much.
Yeah, so the stock got hit by a few things. First, there was a report from Hindenburg Research, which is a short selling firm, which means that they profit when the stock falls. So they released this enormous report that said, you know, Nikola is basically an intricate fraud. They've exaggerated their technology. They faked product launches. In that report, they said they never seen this level of deception in the public company. So, of course, that made a big splash on the street. And, you know, the stock had already run up a lot, which people had already said maybe it had surpassed You know, it was no longer trading based on its underlying fundamentals. It was now just trading on emotion as retail investors, among other people, got into that stock. So that hit the firm really hard and shares immediately sold off. Now, Hindenburg released their report just a few days after Nikola announced an agreement with GM, whereby GM would take an 11% stake in the company, and then they would be the ones that would engineer and manufacture Nikola's pickup truck known as the Badger. So that was a big deal. You know, Wall Street analysts had said that that really validated Nikola's business model to have OEM GM say, okay, we believe in you guys. We want to partner with you guys. So then the Hindenburg report was released, the stock sold off, and then that ultimately led to the executive chairman and founder of the company, Trevor Milton, stepping away. He had kind of really been an Elon Musk-type figure where he frequently turned to social media, including Instagram and Twitter, to talk about the company and, you know, its promises and its progress. He frequently cited, you know, trolls and responded to critics, and he was just very much on Twitter a lot of the time. So after that Hindenburg report, he ultimately stepped away from the company. And then the deal with GM was supposed to close at the end of September. But, you know, obviously after Hindenburg's report and the kind of pickup it had on the street, because, you know, short selling reports don't always lead to stock selling off. But clearly investors thought that there was something in that report. So then GM and Nikola did not close that deal as they were supposed to on September 30th. Right now, the talks are ongoing, but so far nothing has been finalized. They have until December 3rd to reach a deal, at which point either side can walk away. So, you know, we'll see what happens. The company last week reiterated its business model, reiterated its technology, its hydrogen fuel cells, and its timeline. Of course, they have said that Hindenburg's report was based on, you know, all false statements. And they refuted it, but the report has reportedly led to investigations from both the SEC and the DOJ. So definitely a little bit of a rough period here for Nikola.
Given that Nikola is now, I guess, essentially a public company, have there been affirmative disclosures by Nikola about what's going on with respect to the federal investigations?
They haven't addressed it, no. So we have yet to, we have yet to see what's going to happen. You know, I should note that investigations aren't in, you know, don't necessarily mean that there was any wrongdoing. Investigations are pretty frequent, but we don't have any information on the findings of that yet.
So to wrap up our conversation with you, you know, you had talked about three trends that were coming about with Nikola being in the center of them. Can you talk about this final trend, and that's the accessibility and ease of trading apps like Robinhood and what that's been doing to the marketplace?
So Robinhood really pioneered the zero commission trading model, which other e-brokerages have since followed. And so they launched in 2013, and they created a product that, you know, was really popular with millennials. People have said they kind of gamified stock trading, and their mission is to make the market accessible to everyone, which is a noble mission. But some people say that, you know, there has to be greater education for investors. So during the pandemic, you know, when people had to stay home and there was no sports, we really saw an uptick in the number of retail investors turning to trading as a way to pass the time. You know, Robinhood registered 3 million new accounts in the first quarter alone, and the other e-brokerage sites saw their growth numbers grow as well. We've seen Robinhood traders in particular kind of pile into some riskier areas of the market, and part of that is because they are given access to complex financial derivatives such as options. They're allowed to trade on margin, which is, you know, borrowed money. So in theory, this is all very good. But if you're a retail investor, you know, if you are young millennial and you don't necessarily understand the inherent risks involved in these strategies, it can lead to heavy losses. And, you know, earlier this year, for example, retail traders piled into names like Hertz and Chesapeake after they had gone bankrupt and drove those stocks way up. And then we saw the same thing with Kodak. We saw that stock rise more than 1,000% in one day. So it's just sometimes there's a disconnect between the knowledge for these investors and the trades that they're executing. And of course, you know, these are, you know, it's it's the extreme examples that are shared in the, you know, Reddit forums and on Twitter that are devoted to, you know, trading. And the vast majority of people on these platforms, you know, presumably execute small level and kind of more predictable trades. But the criticisms that, you know, Robinhood especially have faced is that they have gamified it. So they have things like confetti on the app. And, you know, it's visually appealing to hit buy. And if you want to hit cancel on a trade, it's, you know, it's a couple extra steps. Also, people have said that they don't publicize ETFs in the same way. They show the top 100 stocks on the platform, and they don't show the ETFs. And, of course, you know, it's very hard in the long run to make money as a day trader. And financial experts say that, you know, you should really just buy the S&P if you don't really know what you're doing. And so trading on momentum versus actually looking at a company's fundamentals, their future earnings power, things like that can lead to long-term losses. So very noble mission, but there, you know, we should have some kind of safety net there so that people don't get in over their heads.
Thanks for joining us this morning.
We've been talking to Pippa Stevens.
It may have been some time since you've flown in and out of the Salt Lake City International Airport. If your last trip was before September of 2020, you have a lot to look forward to. Our next highlight is an interview with Nancy Vollmer, Director of Communications and Marketing for the new SLC. This interview took place on October 26, 2020. Listen in as Doug Wells and I speak with Nancy. On September 15, 2020, the new SLC opened, the first new hub airport built in the U.S. in the 21st century. What will travelers remember about the new SLC? From awe-inspiring art installations like the Canyon and the Falls and the Delta Sky Club's outdoor deck with its beautiful mountain views to the electric plug-ins at each seat in the gate waiting areas, eclectic roster of high-end shops and restaurants with street pricing, there's plenty to be impressed with within the new SLC. Joining us to talk this morning about it is Nancy Vollmer, Director of Communications and Marketing at the Salt Lake City International Airport. Nancy, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I love talking about the new SLC, so I appreciate it.
So, Nancy, what can people expect to see when they're at the airport? I know it's coming in phases, so when people go to the airport, not everything is new yet. Talk about what is new and what might still be what we're used to seeing, and when will that be changed?
Actually, that's changing tomorrow. So on September 15th, we opened up a brand new parking garage with twice as many parking spaces. We opened up one central terminal. So before we had Terminal 1, 2, and the International Terminal. Now everyone goes to one place to check in, go to, through security screening. And then we opened up the west end of Concourse A, which is all of Delta's gates. So in between September 15th and October 27th, we have been using some of the existing concourses in the old facility. So Concourse C and what was A and B, we now call it F and G. So it's been a bit of a hike for passengers going through a new security checkpoint and then walking over to those old concourses.
Knowing that even the arrival when you get to the airport for a flight now looks different, should people give some extra time to navigate, or is that not a concern at this moment?
Oh, they absolutely should. We have, this is a larger airport, so it's going to take more time to navigate. And a lot of people think, you know, we've done renovations or we've just expanded, but it is a totally new facility. So our passengers coming into the airport are going to be on a new roadway. We have an elevated roadway for passenger drop-off. And we also have a larger parking garage, so it will take time to figure out how to get from there to the terminal through security screening and onto your gate. So tomorrow when we open up Concourse B, there is a tunnel that was built actually in 2004 in preparation for this project, which gives you an idea of how long we've been planning this for. So the passengers will take a tunnel over to Concourse B, so that will take some extra time. If a passenger was used to going to Terminal 1, going through security checkpoint there, going up to their flights in what was Concourse A, it was much shorter than it will be now.
I know that the renovations helped with operations and efficiencies. Can you let us know what we could, what will passengers perhaps not see but experience?
Well, I don't think a lot of people realize now that the airport's previous configuration was not very efficient. It was a pier configuration, kind of like your fingers. So basically, there was only one aircraft that could go in between those piers at one time. So let's say that your flight arrived early. So that was the good news. But then you couldn't get to a gate. So that was the bad news. With this new linear configuration, it's much more efficient because multiple aircraft can move in and out of the gate areas at one time. The airlines like it because they can get on the ground, they can unload their passengers, load their new passengers, and get back in the air. And the passengers like it because they won't be waiting on the tarmac for a gate.
Let me take the opposite side of that coin. I know a lot of thought was put into the visual appeal of the airport, and investments were made. Talk to us about that. What is some of the visual eye candy that we can look forward to when we all start traveling again?
It is a beautiful airport. And early on in this project, when we were designing how this airport would look, we went out to the local community and we said, what do you want to see in your new airport? And overwhelmingly, people said they wanted to see the beauty of Utah represented in the facility. And so we took that to heart. And you'll see that in the colors, in the artwork. For example, the exterior of the airport is a copper color. When you enter the airport, you'll see some beautiful large-scale art installations that represent the canyons of Utah. We have the falls. It's a piece that is 65 feet from ceiling to floor. It's dichroic glass. It reflects the sunlight and creates different colors. The canyon is something that is lit and it goes on the spine of the terminal. It's a beautiful piece. And plus we have art in the security checkpoint area. Each restroom has what's called a whimsy wall. And that's artwork by different local and national artists. Each restroom has a different piece of artwork. I'm really excited tomorrow to open up the Mid-Concourse Tunnel because we have the Four Seasons of Utah represented in that. We have a local artist by the name of Tracy O'Very Covey who did two of the seasons, and then an artist out of Texas, Doss, who did two other seasons. So it's a bit of a walk to go through the tunnel, but it's going to be a beautiful walk. So I think that people are going to be really taken back by seeing that artwork. When we opened up 6 weeks ago, people were just in awe of what they saw. And even every day when I come into work, I see passengers with their phones up taking selfies or just taking pictures of the canyon and the falls because it's just so beautiful.
Well, our guest has been Nancy Vollmer. She's with the new Salt Lake City International Airport. Nancy, thanks for all your work. We've all been hunkering down for 6 or 7 months now. We're all looking forward to seeing it sometime in the near future. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Our final interview today is with the State of Utah Treasurer, David Damshin. Doug Wells and I spoke with Treasurer Damshin on March 9th, 2020.
This morning, we're speaking with David Damshin. He is the Utah State Treasurer. Thank you for coming into studio for this. I mean, you're the treasurer of the state of Utah. That is a big, big job. We're going to talk about some of the other roles, some of the other hats that you wear for the state. But I want to go into another program that the state runs that I think our audience would be interested to know about. I don't have the official name, but it's where somebody may have moved and they have an old bank account that they forgot to close down that has $500 or $1,000. After a certain period of time, those businesses have to remit those funds to the state, where you guys have a nice database where it makes it easy for you to find money that has been yours for a while. You just didn't know about it. You forgot about it. What is that program called and how can people find out about it?
That is, you're referring to our unclaimed property division. It's an agency that I oversee. And we have a website. It's mycash.utah.gov, G-O-V, mycash.utah.gov. You can go to mycash.utah.gov and search, plug in your name. I tell people, search for neighbors, friends, coworkers, businesses that you've been associated with or are familiar with, or you know someone that owns a business, nonprofits, even governments. We have money that's become lost. Some of it's just checks that got lost in the mail and never got cashed. We take in between roughly $30 to $50 million a year. And last year we paid out an all-time high $29.3 million. And the way that we, you know, I'm always driving for higher numbers. This is not our, I tell people, I'm from the government and I don't want your money. And I'm always driving for increases in that, in that productivity. So we're hoping to crack $30 million. And the way we do it is we, and you're helping very much in that regard, is raising awareness that, hey, we have this money. It's not a, believe it or not, this is one of the challenges we face. We have to convince people sometimes it's not a scam. This is a state agency. If you search and you find that we have properties under your name, you initiate the claims process right online. It's a secure website. And the claims process gets kicked off at mycash.utah.gov, and off we go. And I tell people, if you'll sit down for 20 minutes and just think about people that you know and plug in names, you'll find someone that you know, because one in five Utahns have lost properties with us. And furthermore, if you've had lost properties in the past, you have to keep coming back, because as I said, every year we get in, we take in a new $30 to $50 million every single year.
So if I find my neighbors have unclaimed property, what percentage could I ask of the found property?
It depends on how much your neighbor likes you and how large the property is. But it's funny you bring that up. There's a cottage industry called fee finders, and they like to sandwich themselves in and come to people and say, hey, you have lost property, I'll help you get it for a fee. I want to make it clear that we're a government agency. We don't charge a fee. If you are being approached by someone that's saying they can help you get a hold of your lost money and they want to charge you a fee, please just go to mycash.utah.gov and work with my team in unclaim property. We won't charge you a fee. We work for you, the taxpayer, and we want to get that money back to the rightful owner where it belongs.
Okay, well, that's a great service. Thanks for sharing that, and hopefully there are some Parkites that will call into the radio station and let us know their success stories. We've been speaking with David Damshin. He is the Utah State Treasurer. We appreciate you driving up. We didn't even get a chance to mention that if people are skiing out of Powder Mountain and they get hurt, their ski patroller that comes up might actually be the Utah State Treasurer as well.
That's right.
You still work a couple days as a ski patroller?
I still do.
Powder Mountain?
I still do. I love ski patrol. It's a great thing.
It helps keep you young and keeps people safe.
That's right.
Well, David, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for listening to Mountain Money's year-end show.